CliffCentral.com.
The Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're live with us on the Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. Our first show for 2017. Very excited to be here. Greg Nicholson, how are you doing?
Very good, thank you. It was a nice break.
Also another special guest, Simon Ellison. How are you?
Very happy to be back.
How reckon do you keep, think we can keep saying Happy New Year?
How long?
Yeah, how long you keep saying it?
It's a good question, actually.
I think compliments.
Until Valentine's
Day. You know, I wrote to an Ethiopian today, and I was like, Happy New Year. And then I realized, well, Ethiopian New Year is only in September. So you also got to be culturally appropriate in your New Year's greetings.
That's why we say compliments, man. Just keep it brief. Keep it, like, disinterested. Anyway, thanks for tuning in. Sorry it took us a while to get here, the 17th. That's how we do it on our side of the world. Take, like, 8 weeks off. Really excited to be back. We've got a really packed show lined up. We will be talking about President-elect Donald Trump, soon to be President for reals Donald Trump, who's being inaugurated this week. We'll also be talking a bit about the ANC succession, a bit about apartheid-era corruption, and specifically Abs and Sanlam, who've been somewhat implicated in this. And lastly, an outlook on some of the stories to watch from around the continent. So really, really, really packed show. To get started, we've got Jay Brooks Spector on the line. Brooks, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you, and I'm going to put it this way. Happy New Year until the 20th.
There we go.
After that thing.
I mean, I don't even know where to start. We have a new president, the 45th American president, being inaugurated this week. What are you seeing as the sort of the tone, the mood in the run-up? Is there still disbelief about whether this is happening, or is there a sense of, okay, this is the president, we need to get on with it now?
Well, I think we're on step 5 of the 12-step plan for grief and anguish. I it's been accepted that he won. It's been accepted that, however it was fought, he came out on top. John Lewis, congressman from Georgia, the doyen of the civil rights movement at this point in the United States, he was at most of the major civil rights milestones in the South in the 60s and 70s. He's taken to calling Donald Trump the illegitimate president and promised not to come to the inauguration. He's been followed by a number of other Democrats, although no Republicans. And in the last several days, Donald Trump has managed to put the fear of God into people in Germany and other parts of Europe to pick yet more fights with the Chinese, to embrace the angriest version of Brexit in Britain, and continue his love fest with Vladimir Putin. It almost defies understanding. It's as if he read the text, the business textbooks on creative destruction, but left out the creative part. He just focused on the second word.
So, Brooks, one of the interesting things that I was wondering with Donald Trump is on international issues, we, like you said, he has a close relationship or is supportive of Russia's Vladimir Putin. Looks like he might even want to start a trade war with China. He has questioned the relevancy of NATO. He seems to support the breakup of the European Union. How do you think international relations, U.S. international relations, will change after Trump? Can we expect some of these things to actually be enacted, or is this just hot air at the moment?
Well, I mean, part of it is that, you know, if you had to do a weather forecast of Donald Trump, you'd say cloudy with a chance of heavy fog. In other words, it's really, really hard to tell. He's given all kinds of contradictory statements, sometimes within the same breath. He sent out a Twitter storm in many different directions. The good news, if there is any in all this, of course, is he's not president yet, and he doesn't have the kinds of checks and balances that actually come with authority and responsibility, as well as the opportunity to say what you like. The moment he has to deal with allies in a real way, the British, the European Union, the Germans, etc., the moment he has to actually engage with negotiations on one thing or another with China, the moment he actually has to confront the reality of the implications of his comments about the Great Beautiful Wall across the border with Mexico, it becomes different because there are so many other pressures that have to be responded to. You can't tell the other countries what to do. You can't simply whistle and expect the Congress to jump to your brief. And ultimately, in some of the domestic issues, citizens and groups will have access to the courts to try to either block or overturn things that he aspires to. But it, one thing you should note, I mean, even before we start down this path on Friday, is that his popularity ratings have sunk to the lowest of any incoming president since they've been tracking such things. Now, obviously, when Abraham Lincoln took over the presidency in 1861, there were a lot of people in the South who were extremely unhappy with it, but that was a long time ago, and they didn't have public opinion polls back then, and the issues were obviously rather different.
So,
the last 30 years.
Brooks, some commentators might say the opinion polls got it wrong before, so we're not sure if we can get it right again.
Brooks, I want to get in there quickly. You know, perhaps some more accurate weather forecast for Trump's presidency based on recent information might be cloudy with a chance of golden showers.
You get to explain that, not me.
What I want to ask you very, very briefly, because I think we're quite short on time. You know, I don't want to give away your age, but you've been around a little longer than the rest of us. You were around in the Cold War with all the sort of Russian hype, you know, Reds under the bed, the McCarthy era. Are we seeing a repeat now? Russia suddenly seems to be the bogeyman of the day. It's coming up in all sorts of contexts. You know, is this paranoia? Is this scaremongering? Or is there something really there?
Well, I think it's a combination of all kinds of things. I mean, the great irony, of course, is that in the 50s and 60s, the people who pushed hardest for opposition to what was then the Soviet Union were, of course, the Republicans. And any Democrat who aspired to achieving a negotiated settlement on nuclear weapons or anything else was labeled almost instantly as soft on communism, and that made it very difficult, not impossible, but very difficult to achieve success. The difference now is that that Americans largely, if you believe the polling and if you watch the public statements, now, parenthetical moment here, Greg, the polls were right on the gross totals of voters. They did not take into appropriate account the way the electoral votes in three states would fall, which is slightly different, but they called the election wrong, so I'll give you a point for that. But if you go back to the main issue, the Americans largely think that they are facing a resurgent Russia, in this case, eager to reclaim some of its luster when it was the other superpower, in the person especially of Vladimir Putin, who, of course, famously called the breakup of the Soviet Union the biggest tragedy of the 20th century. And if you look at the map and you see its push against Ukraine or Georgia and its active engagement in the Syrian civil war, and its serious disinformation campaigns in large parts of Europe, you see a sense that Russia can be dealt with as a nation and as a government, but there needs to be some resolve in getting the mix right. It isn't simply throw your arms around Vladimir Putin and say he's my brother, and if we're good buddies, that's a good thing, an asset, in Donald Trump's words.
Now, Brooks, because we're running
it's
short,
gotta be more complicated.
Sorry, Brooks, because we're running short on time, we'll just throw a couple more questions out at you. So it seems that a key reason Trump was elected seems to be the stagnation of real income growth in the middle class and the real struggle in the manufacturing sector in certain parts of America. You see Trump saying stuff like America's been ripped off and he's going to stop that. But what can we actually see, or what can we predict at this stage that Trump might actually do in relation to the economy and trade?
Well, I mean, let's get some baseline numbers out there. Leading into the last month of the Obama administration, there have been 75 consecutive months of economic growth, 15.5 million new jobs, unemployment's down to 4.7%, inflation is almost risible, and family income has now slightly average, median average family income has now slightly surpassed the levels where it was just at the beginning of the great financial crisis back in 2008-2009. The saving grace for a Trump administration, it seems to me, is if he can get the numbers, the support, and the balance of policies right on his, what he calls his great boom in infrastructure building, rebuilding the airports, harbors, bridges, roads, railroads, everything else you can think of, that will contribute to a rise in income because it will disproportionately draw in lower income people and make their work higher in demand. It's going to produce a great boom in consumption for building materials, which obviously will be good for those companies and factories that make the stuff. And it may well lead to a better, more, an easier country to work with. On the downside, and I think there are two things to keep in mind since we're living here in South Africa. One, it will push up demand and possibly inflated costs and or shortages in those building materials worldwide. And it also could increase the cost of construction in countries like South Africa, which have their own needs for an infrastructure rebuild.
I mean, thanks for the in-depth answer. I think my final question before we let you go is really just about still predicting the unpredictable, I suppose. And just looking back to Trump's campaign and how we saw him, you know, push ethnic nationalism and sidelining women and minorities, do you see him continuing in this style and embracing, you know, racism, if we're going to call it what it is? Or do you think there'll be a change in him being more of a president for everyone and putting some of that aside now?
Now, look, the man is 70 years old. How many 70-year-olds do you know who suddenly changed their stripes completely? I haven't met one yet. I think, you know, he is what he is. He loves that electronic handheld device to send out those 140-character messages at 6 in the morning or 3 in the morning. What you will see is a staff really desperate to rein him in a little bit. Maybe somebody will take that electronic device and, you know, put a rock on it to keep him away from it. But once the process actually begins and you have to govern, then it becomes, you know, you have to dial it back no matter what your rhetorical stance was. And that's been true of every president up till now. And the only problem with that, of course, is that he really is unique. And maybe he will try to buck the odds and keep going the way he's been. I don't know. It's, as I say, cloudy with a real chance of heavy fog and perhaps thunder and lightning on top of it.
All right. Wonderful. Brooks, thank you so much, and we'll chat to you after the inauguration. Thank you.
I guess we'll have to. Won't
we? We're all here after the inauguration. Talk to you soon.
Gentlemen, I don't know what to say.
I think one of the really interesting things for me on this conversation, and we'll get into it further with Simon a little bit later, is obviously what effect it will have on South Africa and the continent. Simon will allow you to chat on that a little bit later, but I saw some interesting documents that came out recently, I think from Trump's incoming administration, asking all these sort of questions about the US's relations with Africa and sort of giving an indication of where that could shift.
Absolutely. I think there's lots to be worried about, and we'll get into all that.
Okay. I mean, another thing that I think about, probably just me being sentimental, is just how sort of Obama's presidency will age, you know, over the next couple of years, over the next, you know, we still have all these lovely images of him hanging out with 5-year-olds and this loving guy playing basketball. But there's still a lot of criticism from the Middle East about, you know, some not so loving things that he's done. So I really wonder how his sort of legacy will age. But for now, we'll be moving to local stuff. On the line, we've got Ranjani Munusami. Ranjani, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. How are you
wonderful.
Guys?
Hey, wonderful to hear from you. And Jenny, we've seen headlines over the past week, and they've all been different variations of ANC leadership race heats up, ANC divided, ANC this. Is it going to be 12 months of discussing nothing else but who will be the next president of the ANC and the country?
Well, it will be if the other parties are able to keep out of controversy, like, you know, the DA going off on a tour to the Middle East and distracting public attention. But yeah, this is definitely destined to be the ANC year, the year of the succession battle. And as has been the case in 2007 and 2012, you know, the national dialogue is very much centered around that succession battle, and the conversation certainly in ANC structures from branch level to national level is consumed by this idea of who is going to take over next.
Now, as you speak to, I mean, to your sources and different members and, I suppose, party leaders, is there a feeling that they're trying to remain united and fight against some of the factionalism that we're seeing? Or is it really just about people trying to make sure that the host they're backing ends up in charge?
Yeah, that's a difficult one because, you know, the ANC always puts out this impression that, you know, that particularly, you know, in times of difficulty, that, you know, its main focus is to unite structures and unite people and to denounce factions. But really, you know, that's very difficult to achieve. You know, the latest thing by the ANC now is to try and contain the succession discussion and deny that it's even happening. And that's trying to deny somebody, you know, who's 9 months pregnant to say, oh, no, let's not tell anybody until it's the right time. And what is the right time to have this discussion? And the reason why this discussion is happening and various people and various organizations within the ANC are trying to lead the discussion is to swing sentiment within the ANC and to lead the discussion so that it favors their faction. So, for example, you have the ANC Women's League coming out on the eve of the ANC January 8th celebrations to say that Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma is their candidate, and she's the only one whom they believe can lead the ANC. So what that did then is you project Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma as the candidate who will represent women's interests in the ANC. Now that's not necessarily true because she's a woman, yes, but what else is she saying? What issues is she floating on behalf of women? That's what the ANC Women's League can't really answer. So through that, you can then read that what they're doing actually is just to sway the field towards their own interests and the interests of the camp they find themselves into. And that's what you'll find from various factions in the ANC, you know, these maneuvers and board games to try and to tilt, you know, sentiments towards their interests.
Ranjani, I just wanted to ask you, there's been a lot of criticism of certain media outlets in recent weeks because they've written about this and they've described Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma often as the president's ex-wife. Often in headlines, that's been the sort of principal descriptor, almost as if that is her only qualification. Do you think that this, I mean, the controversy around this is fair, or is it true that, you know, she has got where she is because of her connections?
Oh, absolutely not. Jacob Zuma and their relationship ended in the late 90s, if I remember correctly. And she was a prominent figure in the ANC before that divorce and certainly after that divorce. And all her, you know, the role she has played in the South African government and the African Union Commission had really nothing to do with Jacob Zuma or their relationship. But, you know, the thing is that her candidacy is viewed through the prism of her relationship with the president because he is such an overarching figure in South African politics right now. And because he kind of, you know, dominates discussions, you know, and, even with regard to the succession battle, it's about whether his faction will remain in power, and keep its grip on politics and financial interests in the country. And therefore, I think it's convenient and lazy for some media houses to then link Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma to, you know, her previous marriage, through her previous marriage to the president, and think that that is what will define what she will do if she is elected president. And I think that it goes much deeper. It's much more complex. And people need to be able to analyze who and what Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma is based on who she is. And, yes, her relationship with the president is a factor, but not the marriage relationship, but very much the political relationship.
Ranjini, some of the other candidates for President Zuma's successor as leader of the ANC that have been mentioned are, of course, Boleka Mbete, even Ace Magashule. But one of the key candidates, obviously, and has the backing of COSATU, is Cyril Ramaphosa, the current deputy president. Do we know yet if he has... If he's building a key constituency behind him, do we know if he has a significant block or blocks of the ANC who will be able to back him and actually rival a candidate like Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma?
No, his constituency is not clearly defined, and that's Cyril Ramaphosa's biggest problem. Is that at the time when he was out of active politics, he remained a member of the ANC National Executive Committee. But he didn't do much to service what was his constituency, which was the workers. You should remember his role in the National Union of Mine Workers, and even as Secretary General of the ANC in the early 90s. He then did command quite a following in the ANC, but that kind of dissipated when he was a businessman. And this is the problem with his candidacy now, is that with him being reluctant to engage properly on the succession battle, he's not defining what he will do as an ANC leader. And therefore, it's difficult for constituencies to rally behind him. So at the moment, what you're finding is that people in the ANC, members and structures who are backing Cyril Ramaphosa, are doing this mostly to counter the other faction, the other dominant faction in the ANC, which is known as the Premier League. Mm-hmm. So they feel that he is basically the anti-Zuma candidate, and that's why they should rally around him. So it's not so much for what he stands for, but for the fact that he's not the leader of that other faction and not associated with that other faction. And they're guessing that he could possibly, put that faction in its place and, take the ANC off on another path from what it has been under the Zuma presidency.
Now, Ranjini, we've been talking about possible who may possibly be the next ANC president, but of course there's a bigger issue that's the backdrop of this, is that we've seen over recent years is these sort of election races within the ANC and how they're held have often deepened factionalism within the party and even encouraged patronage. And we all know now that in the middle of the year, at the ANC's policy conference, there'll be this consultative conference tacked on the end of it to try and work out some of these party issues. Do you see any way that the party can, and with these interventions from veterans and so on, that the party can actually tackle some of these challenges that seem to have it on a spiral of increasing factionalism?
Look, it's very difficult to do that in an election year because the atmosphere is so charged, and ANC structures are so polarized around the succession battle. So it's difficult to deal with the major problems in the ANC, such as corruption and factionalism and patronage and, the capture of ANC structures and ANC leaders. All of that is very difficult to do, when you have this conference coming up. But the intervention by the ANC veterans certainly wants to try and deal with some of the problems. So although it was announced that the consultative conference would be tagged on to the policy conference, they are trying to have this consultative conference earlier in the year precisely to deal with some of these problems. So the issue of who attends the policy conference and the national conference, so, this thing of vote buying and fake members and gatekeeping, all of that can then be dealt with before the policies conference and the national elective conference. So I don't know. Yesterday there was a meeting between the veterans and the ANC top six, top five. Cyril Ramaphosa was in Davos, but there's some agreement that they will work further on it. So if that consultative conference can happen earlier, as the veterans want to, possibly the ANC could then confront these issues, and there could be some amount of healing and problem solving. But, it's very difficult to do it because I think the people who are in charge of ANC structures, so the heads of the regions, the provinces, are, going to be protective over their structures and the people in those structures because, you know, they control them and they hold a sway over who they'll vote for. So I you know, there may be resistance to this intervention from the veterans, for example, because that will then possibly change, you know, some of the membership structures and the affiliation of these people, some of these people in these structures. So that could sway the outcome of the elective conference if the people who attend the conferences change from who they want them to be.
Adenu Onusami, thank you so much for the detailed analysis. We know we have to let you go. We'll speak to you soon.
Thank you, guys. Right. Bye-bye.
Wonderful. Thank you.
If you're just tuning in to Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central, joined in studio by Greg Nicholson and Simon Allison. Now, jumping back to something we alluded to earlier when we're speaking about the Trump inauguration, is focusing more on our relationship to the coming inauguration. sorry, excuse me. Now, Simon, you mentioned a list of sort of questions that were floating around, sent by or circulated by the transition team, questioning U.S. interest in Africa.
The transition team and Trump himself have not sort of mentioned Africa at all. So Africa watchers are scrambling to figure out what Trump means for Africa, and we've all put in our two cents on what we think is going to happen, but of course this is just guesswork at the moment. So the first real indication that we've had of what the Trump team might be thinking is this list of questions prepared by the transition team and given to the State Department. This is information that Trump wants about Africa. And the questions are, the tone of the question suggests that we're going to see a change in policy. They sort of phrase along the lines of, how much do we give in aid to Africa and why is so much of it stolen? Why do we bother funding the fight against Al-Shabaab for 10 years and we still haven't won it? Why have we not brought back our girls, referring to the Boko Haram mass kidnapping of school children? So they are quite shallow questions. What they seem to indicate is that there are three things that Trump is worried about. Number one, he's worried about the relationship between America and Africa when it comes to aid. And this is something where I feel that we could see real change in America cutting back its aid budget to Africa. We're already seeing European countries do this already. So it really wouldn't be much of a surprise. Are we fitting in with a global trend? And, you know, it also fits in with Trump's statements of putting America first. Why give all this money to Africa? What do they give us in return? Number two is the counterterrorism efforts. And the tone of these questions were interesting on that front, because they were sort of saying, well, we're putting all this money into counterterrorism. What are we getting in return? Why aren't we winning? Why are they still bad guys? I suspect that given the very military defense bent of Trump's administration, we will see American counterterrorism operations in Africa continue and possibly even expand. I'm very worried that any sort of breaks on human rights violations will also be removed, because those are deemed ineffective. We've already heard Trump say he will bring back certain forms of torture. What kind of message does that send to various African leaders who may already be committing some of these crimes? Kingsley, you're Kenyan, you know what's going on in your country. And a lot of it is funded by the U.S., either directly or indirectly. So expect more funding for African militaries without much in the way of human rights considerations attached to that. The third big thing is the AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunities Act. This is the deal whereby African countries get free access to American markets. The questions suggest that Trump is very skeptical of this. Of course, we know he's skeptical of trade deals in general, but he is particularly skeptical of trade deals that seem to be more like an aid deal, which is what AGOA has been described as in the past. So I think countries that rely on AGOA, like Swaziland and Lesotho especially, I think almost its entire economy is dependent on that AGOA access, could be in real trouble if that act is scrapped.
What about for the rest of the continent, if we start with AGOA? How important is that deal? and how sizable, how much does it help our African export markets?
Look, I don't have the numbers, but it is important. It's a very major factor for most economies that want to get into some kind of manufacturing. It's also about future growth. So the idea is that, well, you can set up a factory because you know you're going to have tariff-free access to American markets. You've got somewhere to export your goods to for the next however long. If that suddenly disappears, then what are those factories going to do? Where they're going to export to? So I think it really could have a pretty serious knock-on effect on manufacturing all over the continent.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested also in, so when I read that, those questions about, you know, why haven't we yet defeated Al-Shabaab? Why haven't we been able to take on Boko Haram and bring back these girls? My reading of it was that they would, I didn't think too much about it, but I was thinking, maybe they're not going to intervene militarily so much anymore, offer so much support. But what you're saying is that what you think that they might do, that the US now, is perhaps increase their anti-terrorism here, but with a particular stronger military bent, perhaps with more force, which I think raises an immediate concern of perhaps sovereignty and human rights abuses.
Sovereignty, not so much, no. I think, because like America has moved away from the direct intervention model that we've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan. Instead, what it's tending to do in Africa is fund African militaries to do the same job. So rather than put troops on the ground to fight Boko Haram, let's give the money to the Nigerian army, the Chadian army, etc., and let them do the dirty work, let them suffer the casualties. So I think the sovereignty issues might remain intact, but absolutely human rights abuses is something I'm extremely worried about. I've done a little bit of research for a bigger story that's coming out later this year on how America funds African militaries and how that money is then used by security forces, which go on to commit human rights abuses with absolutely no checks or balances. So in theory, under law, America is not allowed to give any money to military units that commit human rights abuses. Mm. But in practice, two things happen. Number one is that the money carries on, you know, it carries on regardless. You know, even though human rights abuses are reported in, say, Kenya, Kenya still receives money. And the second thing that happens is that countries have become very wise to this law. And the phrasing was clever. It was cannot give money to military units, not militaries in total. So they say, okay, well, we don't need money for this unit which has been implicated in human rights abuses, but we'll have money for this other unit over here, which is a nice clean record and a brand new name. And of course, it amounts to much the same thing because the money ends up in the same places and the human rights abuses keep happening. And the US has effectively been turning a blind eye to this already under Obama's administration. Now, Obama has at least used the rhetoric of human rights, and occasionally his government has you know, at least said to offenders like the Nigerian government, oh, you need to watch your human rights record, etc. I don't think any of those even rhetorical breaks are going to be put onto recipients of U.S. aid under a Trump administration.
I mean, straying a bit from Trump. I mean, just when I read some of the questions that were circulated and trying to put, you know, the Trump angle just out of my mind. I think a lot of those are really valid questions of an incoming president looking and saying, where are these people we're supposed to be finding? Where are the girls that were lost and were supposed to be, you know, bringing back? Where's the Joseph Kony that was on YouTube and Facebook every day, whatever year that was, that we're supposed to be catching? So is there a perspective that says you have a new president who's coming and asking tough questions that should be asked about how much are we spending in region X, and what's the value in it for us? What's in it for us?
Yes and no. So these are good questions. Yeah. There's no doubt about it. Yeah. But they are being asked. And certainly, you know, U.S. departments are asking it themselves. People are asking it of the U.S. and other people involved in Africa. Okay. These are questions that are not new. Basically what the questions suggest is that no one who has any real connection to Africa was involved in the drafting of those questions, because they're questions that if you did follow the continent closely and if you were, you know, connected into its politics, you'd know the answers to those questions. You'd know why we haven't brought back those girls. You'd know why Al-Shabaab is still fighting even after all the money that's gone in. You'd be asking more nuanced questions, I think. Sort of, you know, could we be funding these peacekeepers instead of these peacekeepers in Somalia, rather than the, you know, the big simplistic questions. So it really feels like it's someone who doesn't know much about Africa, has read a few headlines and thinks these are the questions we need to ask. Having said that, yeah, you're right, Kingsley, they are good questions. And I doubt we'll be able to see the State Department's responses to those questions, but that would be really interesting too.
And also be interested to see, I mean, as we wrap this up, just how much the president is able to do. I mean, Brooks mentioned it, just when you have Congress and you have all these interests, is it actually possible to come in and scrap this and change that spending and change all that? Or is it, does he actually?
Exactly. And another possible thing which, yeah, which we should mention, yeah, is the main candidate for the State Department, Undersecretary for Africa, I'm not sure what the job title is, but the main African guy in the State Department is a guy called J. Peter Pham. And he has been the Africa head of the Atlantic Council, which is a think tank in Washington, D.C. Okay. He does know his stuff, absolutely. He's an expert in the field, a very old hand. You know, so if he does get appointed, the Trump administration will have someone reliable in the African context that they can count on.
Okay. We'll keep watching that after the inauguration. Now, Simon, you've been doing some thinking about some of the, you know, stories across the continent to watch. And one of the things or the countries you've mentioned is Gambia. Now, I'm a bit embarrassed because one of the last times we had you on was probably election day or the day after. And we were so excited. We were like, this is what democracy looks like. This is amazing. And I don't think we had a chance to close the loop on that. So if you only get your news from the Daily Maverick, you have a bit of...
As you should, right?
Which, we, you know, we've got a bit of catching up to do. So, Simon, if you could take us a bit back, what on earth happened? We had this exciting...
Oh, man, we were so excited.
Moment.
We were so excited.
What changed? What's going on?
So, I think Jammeh came to his senses. He had a brief moment of losing the plot completely and accepting that he'd lost the election, and then realized, oh no, I'm meant to be a badass old school dictator. I can't possibly lose an election and hand over power peacefully. So he hasn't. He's basically reversed himself. He said no. There was a technicality in the elections, which means the whole thing is flawed, and he is challenging the results in court. So therefore, no one can be inaugurated as president until that challenge is heard. Now, the inauguration is due, today's the 17th, so Thursday. In 2 days' time, we're due to have this inauguration. The court has not heard Jammeh's application. Now, the reason for this is crazy. The Gambia is so tiny that it does not have enough qualified people to staff its own Supreme Court. So I'm not sure if it's most or a significant proportion of the judges on the Supreme Court actually come from Nigeria.
Okay.
So they do their Nigerian job most of the year, and then occasionally they'll fly into the Gambia to hear a few Supreme Court cases. Now, this is not as crazy as it sounds, actually. In Southern Africa, we do much the same thing. Not South Africa specifically, because we've got plenty of trained professionals, but the likes of Swaziland and Lesotho and Namibia, I think, they have very similar legal systems, and they switch around lawyers all the time.
Okay.
So in the last Lesotho crisis, one of the key players was the Deputy Chief Justice, and he was from Swaziland.
Okay.
You know, so this does happen,
okay,
even though it's super weird. But these Nigerian justices on the Gambian Supreme Court are currently in Nigeria, busy with their normal job.
The Nigerian cases.
And they've written and said, look, we can't just rock up for an emergency session because you want us to. We come in May to November, I think.
Oh, they have
schedule
time.
They have schedules.
Oh, I understand.
So
yeah.
You gotta accept the schedule. Now, there's got to be politics at play here, because surely if Nigeria wanted this to be sorted, they would have just said, guys, you can clear a couple of days, go hear the single most important legal case in the history of the Gambia, and then come back.
Yeah.
So I don't quite buy that they just couldn't change their
busy
schedule.
The timetable
cannot
be moved. Okay.
There's a hierarchy of priorities, and surely the entire future of a country trumps most other priorities. But anyway, that is the situation. We're not going to have a court case hearing this. We are scheduled to have an inauguration on Thursday. The president-elect, Adama Barrow, is not even in the country. He's in Senegal, ostensibly because he's, you know, visiting the region, etc., but really because he's very scared for his own safety, and he should be. Things are really tense. We know that the president-elect's son died yesterday after being bitten by a dog. On the surface, it doesn't sound like anything more than an accident, but of course the rumors are flying, the conspiracy theories are out in force. Things are very tense. At the same time, the region, ECOWAS, this is the Economic Community for West African States, they are preparing a military intervention force. And they've actually gone so far as to put 800 Nigerian troops on standby and British instructors, who are actually there for training against Boko Haram, are now training them for sort of how to handle a military intervention, which is quite fascinating. So the colonial influence lingers. I'm sure that's the argument that President Jammeh is going to make. So who knows what's going to happen? Will ECOWAS actually use its military force? Will it have to? Maybe Jammeh will step aside just in time. His allies within the country are all dropping like flies. So first of all, he lost a lot of the professional associations like the lawyers and the trade unions, etc. Now he's losing ministers. The information minister, today it was the foreign minister. There have been reports also today that the justice minister has defected. His cabinet, his inner circle is saying, no, this cannot stand. You need to go. And I think that's because... That's not because they're nice guys. It's because they can see the writing on the wall. They know that Jammeh's time is up and they want to make sure that they are not implicated. So I think that what that is telling us is that President Barrow may or may not be inaugurated on Thursday, but I think he will be inaugurated soon.
If we just look at ECOWAS for a moment, often people complain about the ineffectiveness of the African Union, and often when these crises happen, about how little they get done. Is ECOWAS and the unity its leaders have shown, and sort of decisiveness they've shown over this issue, is that a positive thing?
I think so. ECOWAS is a fascinating case study in how norms in Africa around changing of power and constitutionalism are changing, and they're changing fast. If you look at a lot of the major players in ECOWAS, all of them came to power in peaceful, democratic changes of power. So you've got Muhammadu Buhari in Nigeria, who last year replaced Goodluck Jonathan after an election. You've got Macky Sall in Senegal, who replaced Abdoulaye Wade in an election. You've got Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. Who else have you got? Can't remember at the moment, but all of the main players... they themselves spend lots of time in opposition politics, and this is important to them. It's actually made it's relevant to their personal career trajectory, and they want to see it enforced. You know, I think it was last year or the year before, at the ECOWAS summit, all the leaders got together and said, you know what, we want to make two terms. The maximum number of terms that any president in the ECOWAS region can have. And all of the leaders said, yes, this is a good idea. Except, can you guess? President Jammeh from the Gambia, as well as the Togolese president. It really is, within the ECOWAS region, these values of democracy and constitutionalism, gone is the other one. We've just had Nana Akufo-Addo elected. Well, it's quite interesting that of the sort of three most important regional blocks, you've got ECOWAS, you've got the East African Community, and you've got the Southern African Development Region, are all pursuing three completely different models, but they're embodying their sort of development values very well. So you've got ECOWAS, which is like going way ahead of the others in terms of democracy, etc. Yeah. You've got SADC, which has said stability at all costs. We're going to keep things peaceful, no conflict, and they have succeeded. There hasn't been an open conflict in Southern Africa since when? I can't imagine. Since South Africa invaded Lesotho at that time that Mangosuthu Buthelezi got a bit excited.
It's always a great story, but like, for another time.
The East African Community, on the other hand, has said business, trade, absolutely, and development, and we're going to open our borders, we're going to take away tariffs, etc. And they've done an amazing job of doing that. So all three, you know, as much as all these regional organizations get criticized because they've, you know, like SADC is terrible in ensuring democratization, and the EAC is also not very good at managing conflict, for example, if you look at Burundi. They are doing one thing right. So now we've just got to figure out how to get all of them to do all the things right, then we'll be sorted.
Okay. That's such a perfect summary. All of you just meet, just spend a weekend in a boardroom and just figure it out. I want to talk about a bit about Angola, speaking of, you know, African big men that may or may not be, you know, be stepping away from power. Is President José dos Santos, is he genuine in his sort of remarks last year that he will be stepping away and that there will be a move of the dos Santos family away from power? Or is he simply stepping away from political power and setting us up for his daughter to take up economic power that is, you know, a lot more certain longer to the future?
Okay, let's tackle dos Santos himself first. Will the president actually step aside? I think that the prognosis is quite good on this front, and there are a couple of reasons for that. Number one is that dos Santos himself has been quite involved in the mediation in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's been telling Joseph Kabila, the president of Congo, that he needs to step aside, that every leader must have his day and then retire peacefully, and that he intends to do so himself. So he has been walking the talk when it comes to international mediation, which makes me think that is where his thinking's at, that he is intending to step aside. Number two is that he has anointed or appeared to anoint a successor. Of course, this is all, you know, reading the tea leaves, because like solid information is quite hard to get. But it does appear that the defense minister, I can't remember his name, we were looking it up earlier, it sounds like the Mozambican beer, Laurentina, but it's not quite that.
I'm on it.
Greg will have it in a second.
He has appointed a successor. Now, what most dictators who want to stay in power do is they never appoint a successor. They always make sure that they're playing off one faction against the other. So it looks like he's planning for an orderly transition. And the third thing that he's done is he's really brought up his children well. Now, you can't say that for all dictators. President Mugabe springs to mind. There's a reason that none of the Mugabe children are actively involved in politics today, and that's because they're not really competent. They're not considered able to take over the reins. Mugabe himself does not trust his children to safeguard his own future because they're not very good at it. There's a lot of rumors that they're drug addicts, et cetera, or addicted to the high life. You know, they're just not suitable candidates.
So to give you the chosen successor's name, apologies for my Portuguese pronunciation, but João Lourenço.
Beautiful. That sounded good to me.
You've got successor.
So President dos Santos, on the other hand, is quite different. His kids are competent. Not all of them, but two in particular. His son, José Filomeno, who is head of the Sovereign Wealth Fund. So Angola has like put a lot of its oil money into the Sovereign Wealth Fund, which they invest in mostly in Portugal. They own incredible assets in Portugal. So this is a very, very clever businessman, very clever guy. He knows what he's doing. The other one, of course, is Africa's richest woman, Isabel dos Santos, President dos Santos' daughter, an incredible businesswoman. She also is extremely competent. She can be relied on to keep pulling those same levers of power that President dos Santos has been pulling to protect him and his family all these years. So there's a reasonable chance that dos Santos can retire, and he knows he's got his own man in the presidency that he's selected, and he's got his son and his daughter holding the strings of the financial strings of the country to keep him exactly where he wants to be. So he can, you know, play golf or whatever retired dictators do in relative peace and comfort.
Okay, so we've got time for one more country. Are we going to do Sudan or Kenya?
Let's do Kenya, Kingsley.
Okay.
Let's turn the tables a little bit, because you have just come from 3 weeks in Kenya. What is the atmosphere leading up to the elections this year? Is it this year or next year?
Yeah, it's this year.
This year.
Okay. So I found a lot of interesting in terms of that when we talk about the sort of post-fact era. I just found it interesting how the same allegations would be made about institutions that are conflicting. So, for example, a lot of people will say that all the media is biased against the state. A lot of people will also say that the media is in the state's pocket. And we're looking at the same newspapers, we're looking at the same things, and people will, like, you know, go to battle for these views. And I found a lot... a lot of those kinds of examples where the same thing is used as evidence of sort of everybody's side, and which was interesting to see how sort of polarized things are. In terms of what's sort of dominating the conversation, absolutely corruption is probably going to be the center of what comes out of this next election. There's real, I mean, we're talking about, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars if we talk to USD. That's disappeared from really, really important organs, such as we're talking health. And when the doctors who are currently on strike, the public doctors or the doctors in public hospitals are currently on strike, and you find out that, you know, $X hundred million was disappeared, then it's pretty hard to explain, you know, why you should remain in power. So there's a lot of things that will need to be explained by the sort of sitting party. That's President Kenyatta's Jubilee. At the same time, you have to factor in the tribal element, where it's not, unfortunately, Kenya's still in a place where it's not purely about issues and policy. There's a big layer of whose tribe is aligned with whose tribe, and do you have enough numbers?
And who has enough numbers?
I mean, there's still the same lines drawn from the last election, which is President Uhuru Kenyatta and his running mate William Ruto, who you will recall had been summoned to the ICC to answer a few questions, and you have Raila Odinga and who will probably be his running mate Salim Mudavadi on the other side. It's pretty close. If you see the last two elections, you had just over 50%, but. The Kikuyu, who is Uhuru Kenyatta's tribe, and who they have been aligned with for the past couple of elections, have come out on top. So that's President Mwai Kibaki, that's President Uhuru Kenyatta. So for now, there's still that 50% and just enough to make it happen, and that's sort of where things are sitting.
And do you see, you know, the country is still scarred from the post-election violence, 2008?
Yeah, 2007, 2008. It was December period. Yeah.
Again, going into elections, are we worried of a repeat performance?
I mean, this is a question that I asked quite a few people. I think one thing that's important to note, because it's a fact, is that a lot of the vernacular radio stations that are not in English or Swahili, they're in, you know, Kikuyu, in Maasai, or in Kikamba, a lot of them are acting as if nothing happened. And they're still speaking completely along tribal lines, and who needs to be kicked out of what province, and who needs to be kicked
and
out of what
And that same
country.
Inflammatory language.
Absolutely. A lot of the stations are really just going on as if nothing happened. Of course, this is often limited because not everybody speaks every language. But if you sort of ask around that, and that's really worrying, because that is happening. You know, regardless of whether people act on it, a lot of the vernacular radio stations are increasingly inflammatory in the stuff they're saying about, we need to kick these people out, or we need to do this and defend these regions, which is extremely worrying.
It's worth noting that, sorry, Greg, one of the accused at the International Criminal Court was Joshua Arap Sung, who was a radio broadcaster.
Absolutely.
I was just going to say, Kenya passed a new constitution after that post-election violence. Were there mechanisms put in place to prevent a repeat of such sort of events?
Absolutely. There is a body. I'll tell you the name just now. There is a body. I know it's led by a man called Ole Kaparo, which is supposed to watch over things like this and basically, you know, bring these stations, you know, to explain what they're doing and why they're doing it. And there's been no response, you know, from that office, certainly. And a lot of people are asking what's going on. A second thing is something that the senators were debating was a lot of the things passed in the constitution around the elections and how it should work. How do we declare financing? And a big question is the digital versus manual voting systems. And is it digital? Do you have a backup that's manual? And that was a massive thing that the two parties went to head on, you know, as senators. And what you can already see is, again, the lack of a basic bedrock of facts of what does it mean for something to be digital? What does it mean for a backup to be manual? So on one hand, it's, of course, it makes sense for it to be digital and a backup to be manual. That makes sense. That's how life works. On the other hand, it's saying, no, the only reason you have a digital voting system and a manual backup is so you can say the digital one messed up and then put your own people overseeing the different polling stations, and therefore you can do whatever you want.
How would it work? Would you vote on a computer and then also vote on a...
Exactly. And then you have sort of both.
That seems like a recipe for mass confusion.
that's the current thing. Is the electricity in all the polling stations? I wish we had more time. But basically, that laws have been passed to really water down the sort of electoral act that was supposed to be really, really comprehensive around financing, around voting, around digital and manual systems. So there's already a feeling, which which in terms of violence is not a good thing, is already a feeling that the Jubilee Party that's currently in power has already set themselves up to win. Because if you have the majority, you can pass whatever rule you want. And if you can water down laws that limit your access to power, then, you know, you're already home free. I think the last thing that's just worth noting is just around the role of the state when it comes to violence. If you remember, a big part of the violence last time was not just citizen against citizen. It was state coming in and being really violent in how they maintain law and order, in quotes. And the cabinet secretary in charge of this, Joseph Kayseri, has already gone up and said there will be no bloodshed. And there's two ways to take that. One is that we are going to make sure everything goes great. The second is there's going to be the army and the police absolutely everywhere, and you guys are not going to start any shit, pardon my language. And it is definitely the second. So we've already seen a sort of purchase of sort of new military vehicles, police vehicles, and it's pretty clear that the state is going to be all over the country and making sure that nothing happens. It's 2 p.m. So I have the weird honor now of sort of wrapping myself up. For everyone listening, I'm sorry for the very dramatic ending. Greg Nicholson and Simon Nelson, thank you so much. Ranjani and Brooks, thanks for chatting to us. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. We'll try to get Gareth Cliff to give us another hour for next time. Thank you so much. We'll see you next week.
The Dave Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. CliffCentral.com.